You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
Hello and welcome to this edition of Viewpoints. Boris Chassaigne with you for the next 30 minutes. On today's show, former politician turned small business owner weighs on the challenges of running a micro distillery in Quebec.
You try to be competitive, but you know your cost of manufacturing is so high, especially in grain to glass. You can't really compete, and some of them had to close down.
Slam poet and climate activist Quinn McCaskill wants to stimulate your climate imagination through a series of sessions asking residents to think big and create a vision for Chantramar. She's only 18.
You know, we've been doing some good things in this community in terms of climate action, but I thought that it could be really beneficial to have just a community vision for the future of this town that we can all kind of get behind and work towards. So I wanted to, with these climate imagination sessions, kind of create a space where people can come together, use their imaginations, dream big about what the future of Chantramar could look like in a sustainable world.
And Nova Scotia Health is calling more than 160,000 people to verify if they still need a family doctor.
This is more of a proactive mechanism for us to reach out to individuals and determine if they in fact have already been connected to a primary care practice in Nova Scotia. And I think it is money well spent.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
With Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Hello, nice to have you with us again this week. The realities of climate change can be stressful and anxiety-inducing, but environmentalist and slam poet Quinn McCaskill is hoping to alleviate some of that stress by gathering area residents for a blue sky session and vision for a sustainable Chantramar. McCaskill is hosting two climate imagination sessions this summer, asking community members to get together and think big in terms of the future of that New Brunswick region in a changing climate. Where did she come up with that idea? Well, it all started for her when she was just 13 years of age and came across Greta Thunberg, a TEDx talk. Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick.
So I was back in Sackville for the summer after my first year studying sustainability at Dal, and I was just thinking about what I could do in the community. I was sort of thinking about what needed to be done in the community, and I was also reading some books, and two in particular really informed these sessions, and it was Commanding Hope by Thomas Homer Dixon, who's a Canadian author, and he really talks a lot about the need for a vision for a sustainable future that can be kind of the object of our hope, because if we want to have hope for a sustainable future, we kind of have to have a vision in place that we can use to motivate us to work towards. And then the second book was From What Is to What If by Rob Hopkins. And it was really talking about how we're in a crisis of imagination right now. And we've designed our societies in such a way that we don't really have to use our imaginations very often. We're at a time when we really need our imaginations more than ever, because if we want a different future than the one that we're headed towards, which I think most people do, then we need to imagine a different possibility, because without something to work towards, we're just going to kind of keep going along this current trajectory. So in terms of Sackville, you know, we've been doing some good things in this community in terms of climate action, but I thought that it could be really beneficial to have just a community vision for the future of this town that we can all kind of get behind and work towards. So I wanted to, with these climate imagination sessions, kind of create a space where people can come together, use their imaginations, dream big about what the future of Chantramar could look like in a sustainable world.
What will the sessions be like? How will the structure be? Maybe explain a little bit about what people can expect.
Yeah, so I'm holding a session in Dorchester and one in Sackville as well. And it's going to start off with, I'll give like a brief presentation kind of to make sure everyone's on the same page about the climate emergency, knows kind of what the impacts are going to be globally and locally, give people some maybe ideas for some frameworks that they could use to think about a sustainable future. And then, like you said, yeah, I'm just going to turn it over to people, give them the opportunity to just use their imaginations, dream big, brainstorm, no real limits or boundaries at this point. We're just imagining what the future of Tanchmar could be. So we'll have big sheets of paper people can draw, write, make lists, and just think about our community, what we have here, the people and resources that we have to work with, the spaces that we have in Tanchmar, and how they could be transformed into making the community more equitable and more sustainable.
A lot of people, when they start to focus on the climate, you know, when you look at the data, when you read the IPCC reports, you get kind of drawn down and maybe bogged down in a bit of despair. So this is like an antidote to that.
Yeah, no, that's completely true. Yeah, there's a lot of kind of climate anxiety and stress around these issues, and they're often framed as kind of an insurmountable problem that we have to kind of find some way to overcome. But I've always thought that we can also view this as an opportunity, because if we're going to have to transform all of our systems, then we might as well take this opportunity to solve lots of different problems at once, to tackle inequality, social injustices, as well as environmental issues. And so I think, you know, if you put that kind of positive spin on it and look at it as an opportunity, as a chance to really imagine what an amazing potential future could be, then I think that that is a way that you can sort of channel those positive emotions and be taking action at the same time. And that'll help kind of combat those feelings of despair and grief and hopelessness that people can sometimes find themselves experiencing.
I imagine one of the other challenges in a session like this could be just getting people to take the risk of thinking big and dreaming big, because, you know, sometimes if you're, you know, you set like wild goals for yourself, you feel sheepish. You feel like this is, you know, we probably won't be able to achieve this. How are you going to sort of crack people out of that mentality to, you know, to actually dream big?
Yeah, that's a great question, because you're right. Like, a lot of people's first instinct is to kind of think realistically about the problem and sort of try to come up with barriers that might prevent you from actually doing the things that you're coming up with. But I'm going to try to make it really clear that that's not kind of the purpose of these sessions. The goal is really to just leave all of those limitations behind. And I think what'll be helpful is that, you know, I could say that we're imagining a Tanchmar a couple years down the line, and, you know, we don't have to think with today's limitations. We don't really know what the world's going to look like a few years from now. So let's imagine that it looks good and that it looks sustainable and equitable and positive in a community that everyone would want to live in.
So, you know, tell me, how did you come to organize these, and, you know, who's, you know, I see EOS on the poster. So what's their role in this, in these climate imagination sessions?
Yeah, so I kind of pitched this idea at a mayor's roundtable, the Tanchmar Mayor's Roundtable on Climate Change. We had an event. And after I sort of spoke about what I wanted to do, Brittany from EOS came up to me and said she'd love to work with me on this idea. So I've been really grateful to have the support from EOS. They've helped me with funding, with staff time, with promotion and organizing these events. I ran kind of a mini version of these climate imagination sessions at Marshview Middle School back in June. I went into all of the grades 6, 7, and 8 classes, talked a little bit about climate change, and then invited the students to come up with ideas for a sustainable Tanchmar. And that was a really big success. It was kind of like a mini pilot project for these sessions, and I got over 400 ideas from all of the students, which I've been working on organizing. So that was really great.
So you've done a test run, and now it goes, you open the doors to the wider community.
Yeah, pretty much. It'll be a challenge. We'll see if the community is just as good as the students were at coming up with ideas.
What will be your takeaway from these sessions, and will there be a next step, I guess?
Yeah, there will be. I'll be taking all of the ideas that everyone comes up with, and I'll be summarizing them and organizing them in a report that I'll be bringing to the municipality, to the town council and staff, and I'll be telling them, like, these are the ideas that the community wants to see implemented. And I know that the town is currently working on developing a sustainability plan, and maybe there's a role for these ideas to kind of inform this plan a little bit, or at least act as guidance for where the municipality could go from here with their climate action projects.
I want to ask you a bit about yourself and your background in climate activism and climate work. Tell me. I mean, when did you first become really conscious of the extent of the problem that we have facing us?
Yeah, well, I know we were talking a little bit earlier about my family being very involved, my parents, my grandparents. So I've always kind of been aware of these sorts of things ever since I was like 3 or 4, talking about kind of environmental issues. And I definitely had a really deep respect and appreciation for nature and animals. And that was where I really got started from a very young age. But then when I got really more so involved was during the climate strike movement, which started when I was 13. So I was involved in organizing strikes here in Sackville and speaking more broadly about these issues. I presented at a lot of different events to educators, to students, to elected officials. And yeah, my message has always just been that we need urgent action. And I want to make sure that we're always thinking about this problem, because it really is the defining issue of our time. And it's the one that's going to impact all other issues as well. So yeah, so I've kind of always been involved, and I'm just looking to continue kind of on this path.
Who should come to these climate imagination sessions? Who do you want to, you know, who do you want to show up? It's at Dorchester, Greater Dorchester Moving Forward, Station 8 on July 31st in the evening, and then August 10th at the Sackville Commons in the afternoon. So who should come?
Everybody. I would love to see everyone show out to these events. There's no age limit. I'd love to see young people. I'd love to see older folks, families, anyone really, because I would love if these sessions could represent like a really broad cross-section of the community. There's no obligation to have any prior sort of like knowledge or background about climate change or anything. I'll be talking a little bit about that, but that's also not even really the main focus of these events. It's just thinking about our community. So anyone who really cares about the future of our town and what we want it to look like, I would love to see all of them out at the event. Even if you don't have any specific ideas to come with, just come on out and be part of it, and maybe you'll get some ideas along the way.
Thanks so much for coming in, Quinn. And yeah, we look really looking forward to these sessions.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, one of these two sessions has passed. The other is scheduled for August 10th at the Sackville Commons.
Hello, I'm Candace Vetter in Embrim, Ontario, and you're tuned into Viewpoints. Follow us on X at Frequency News. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Micro distilleries in Quebec are facing significant difficulties, including financial problems. Many have closed their doors in recent years. Pierre-Luc Dussault, a former Canadian politician who became the youngest MP in history at age 19, now runs a micro distillery in Sherbrooke, Quebec. Dussault, like others, is feeling the pressure, saying distilleries have low profit margins and high production costs. He advocates for lower taxes and additional distribution channels beyond the Société des Alcools du Québec, just like the LCBO in Ontario, this to help these small businesses thrive. More on this with Derek Bullard in Sherbrooke, Quebec.
Today we discuss an issue that is affecting many local micro distilleries here in Quebec. Recently there have been several closures due to financial difficulties, and we wanted to explore the topic further. I had a chance to speak with Mr. Pierre-Luc Dussault, a former Canadian politician who was elected to the House of Commons of Canada in the 2011 federal election at the young age of 19, becoming the youngest member of parliament in the country's history. Pierre-Luc has since left politics and is now running a micro distillery in Sherbrooke. Of course, we had to ask Pierre-Luc how life was outside of politics and how he became involved with micro distilleries.
Well, thanks for asking. Life is great. It's been 4 years now that I completed my second mandate in politics. And I already at that point had a passion for spirits. And that's why I had that in mind to maybe discover more or, make a project out of this passion. And so I was very interested in the process of making and manufacturing a spirit. And the reason is when I, beginning of 2010 to 2015, there was not much Canadian or Quebec made spirit on the market. And I was wondering why. And it is not because it's complicated to manufacture. It's only a reason of history, because we kind of lost this expertise in Quebec a while ago. So I decided to look more into that, and decided that I would make my own business out of this this passion. So that's all it came about.
Pierre-Luc explains the current situation for micro-distilleries in Quebec. In the past few years, several have closed due to financial difficulties. The main issues are the very low profit margins and the high costs associated with producing spirits, especially for those using the grain-to-glass process.
Yeah, so we've seen in the past year or maybe even 2 to 3 years, some distillery that had to close down because of financial difficulties. So and the most recent are three distilleries that had to close down in the past year alone. So of course it gives some questions to customers and people who are interested in this industry. And the main reason is really the financial reason, with very, very low margins for spirits that we can make. And it's even more difficult for distilleries who do grain to glass, as we call it. So when you take the the grain and you ferment it to make alcohol, and then you distill it. So when you take you make all this process, that it's even more expensive to produce. So that's the three distilleries that decided to close down in the past year are three distilleries that were doing grain to glass. So in this this market in Quebec, where the SAQ takes a very big markup, and all the taxes that are special taxes that are imposed on spirit, makes it even more difficult for a business model in grain to glass. So that's the main reason is really financial, and the taxes and the markups and the competition, which is very some big multinational companies are have of course lower prices. So when you try to be competitive, but you your cost of manufacturing is so high, especially in grain to glass, you can't really compete, and some of them had to close down.
Our guest further elaborates on the challenges that are related to getting products into the SAQ.
Yes, of course it's long. It's really long. So when you only have one or two product, and you're waiting as I am, and you're waiting for a new product to get into the retailer. Sometimes it can be tough on the finances of a company, so we are very dependent of the SAQ in this system. So that's why it's more difficult when you have long delays and you have to wait for so long to get product into the market. So that's not only that, but when your product is listed in the SAQ, it's not very easy to get in many stores and do the and be well positioned in those stores. So you have to pay for everything into the SAQ to be more visible and more have better positioning in the on the shelves. So that's one of the difficulty with the SAQ. It's a big machine to try to to figure out everything with them, and you have to wait also a long time to get product in.
Currently, the main market possibilities for selling products are through the SAQ or the distillery boutique. Pierre-Luc and others in the industry are advocating for more distribution channels, such as direct-to-consumer online sales and direct sales to restaurants and bars.
Exactly. So that's one of the solutions we are bringing forward in the industry, is to get more distribution channel. Because we only have the SAQ and our distillery on the distillery boutique that we can have at our place. So that's only two places we can sell, and the SAQ is a big retailers that it's sometimes difficult to get into. So we are trying to develop more distribution channel, like online, direct to consumer online, so which we cannot do right now because we can't ship the bottles of spirits. So we are also looking at direct to restaurant or bar as selling. So right now you have to go through the SAQ because you need the number for the licensee. Yeah. So there's kind of some solutions that that could be easily put in place to give us more distribution channel and maybe channels that are dedicated for Quebec manufacturers, so we can compete more with big brands that are have a lot of money and a lot of resources to get into this. This sector.
Pierre-Luc believes that the solution lies within the Quebec and Canadian governments, and that they should lower taxes for these small distilleries.
The easy answer is lower taxes for us, small distilleries. So we have some recommendation on the federal level to lower the excise taxes for smaller distilleries, so we can have a system more similar with the beer. On the beer, in the beer market, the smaller breweries got a discount on the excise taxes. For us in distillery, there's only one level of tax for any producer, any manufacturer. So we're asking that there's kind of an escalator of taxes, where smaller manufacturer get lower taxes, excise tax. So that's one of our solution on the tax issue. And in Quebec, we're asking, of course, the markups to be lower, if not eliminated, for distillery when they sell on their in their shop. So when you make a sale in the distillery, this could help us be more competitive, of course, than paying a big markup to the SAQ when in the transaction the SAQ was not there. You know, it's between the distillery and the client, right in their distillery shop, and they have to pay the markup to the SAQ, which is a nonsense for us. So that's one of the things we're asking for the Quebec government, and maybe some other program to support us in being more viable businesses, and very interesting business for agro-touristic opportunity, so that the government can see us in actors of this touristic sector, where people would want to discover us as manufacturer of the local product and local spirits in our industry.
Special thanks to Pierre-Luc Dussault, former deputy of Sherbrooke and founder of the McManamy Distillery located in Sherbrooke. For the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Derek Bullard.
Questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca. radio@frequencynews.ca.
And to close our show this week, we'll stay on the East Coast, where Nova Scotia health staff will be calling more than 160,000 Nova Scotians this summer to make sure that they're still looking for a primary care provider. People on the Need a Family Practice Registry are being called now to verify that they still haven't been assigned a doctor or nurse or practitioner. Noella Whelan is heading up the project for Nova Scotia Health. She's the Senior Director of the Primary Care and Chronic Disease Management Network for the department. She said the department did a similar campaign last summer when more than 152,000 people were on the list. That resulted in 17,500 people identified who could be struck from the wait list. Details with Rick Conrad in Liverpool, Nova Scotia.
A group of 40 student recruits have started calling Nova Scotians to see if they still need a family doctor. And with more than 160,000 people across Nova Scotia on the Need a Family Practice Registry, it's going to be a busy summer. Noella Whelan is heading up the project for Nova Scotia Health. She's the Senior Director of the Primary Care and Chronic Disease Management Network for the department. She said Nova Scotia Health did a similar telephone campaign last summer when more than 152,000 were on the list. That resulted in about 17,500 people identified who could be struck from the wait list.
Our systems are not automated, so it relies on the individual that put their name on the list to take their name off the list. And so this is more of a proactive mechanism for us to reach out to individuals and determine if they, in fact, have already been connected to a primary care practice in Nova Scotia. And so often we do find that there are individuals that have been connected to a primary care provider that still remain on the list.
Whelan said they doubled the number of temporary staff making calls this summer from 20 last year. She said there are about 10 other permanent Nova Scotia Health employees on the project in supervisory and coordinator roles.
We have heard from patients and families, you know, the concern about where to go for care. So we want to make sure that we're connecting with folks to understand, do they need a primary care provider? Like, is that still a valid? Do we have their, you know, their contact information so that when we want to reach out to them, we have accurate information? And additionally, we want to ensure while they wait that they know where to go for care. So out of the campaign last summer, there were a number of tools developed to help support individuals to understand where to go for care. And so we just want to make sure that those that are waiting know where to access care.
Operators will also be confirming with people whether their doctor has retired. Whelan says the department doesn't always know if a general practitioner has left their practice.
As we're confirming that folks have retired, we want to make sure that we confirm that and are able to then connect them to a new primary care provider when one becomes available.
Whelan says the project will also give Nova Scotia Health a chance to tell people where else they can access care while they wait for a doctor or nurse practitioner. Staff will also remind people to fill out the health questionnaire on the Need a Family Practice registration site.
Well, I think it is money well spent. Certainly we've heard from the public, from patients, families, that they want to know and want more a direct contact with the system to understand how to navigate services.
Calls will show up as either unknown name and number or from a blocked caller. Staff won't ask for any personal information besides the last four digits of your Nova Scotia health card and your birth date. They'll also ask for confirmation of your phone number and physical and email addresses.
If they do receive a call, and they are not able to respond to the call, if we have their email on file, we'll send them an email and say, we've attempted to call you, please call us back, or we'll make a call during this time in the next day or so. And that way, so Nova Scotians know that this is a legitimate initiative.
Whelan said in the first week of calls, they haven't had many people refuse to answer or give information.
Most folks are engaging in conversation and are able to verify that it is Nova Scotia Health calling.
The project is expected to last until August 31st. I'm Rick Conrad.
And this completes our latest edition of Viewpoints. Thanks to our team this week, our journalists Derek Bullard, Erica Butler, and Rick Conrad, our national editors Victoria Fenner and Maureen McEwen. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. It was nice to have you with us this week, and until the next, take care.